Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Dennis Hart, your host for today. Thank you for listening in. It looks like we're in for the lovely weather characteristic for this time of year as we head into what looks like will be a week of sunny weather with temperatures in the low to mid-70s. We're hopeful that you may be enjoying this Labor Day holiday. On this day, our intrepid seven-county reporters, Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson, bring you news from our beautiful Boone Valley and how to explore the enjoyment and history of that area. In particular, the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway.
Over in Boone, the next three weekends will feature a variety of railroad-related events. The Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad runs a regular schedule from May to Christmas, but the first weekend in September is Puffer Billy Days. Starting with the opening of the carnival in downtown Boone at 5 p.m. on Thursday, September 7th, and ending with the closing of the craft fair at 3 p.m. on Sunday, September 10th. There's live music Thursday, Friday, and Saturday evenings, a parade on Saturday morning, a quilt show, and a variety of food stands and exercise activities to burn the calories acquired. The following two weekends have railroad events that actually involve riding on trains. On September 16th and 17th, as well as the 23rd and 24th, Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad will feature Thomas the Tank train excursions. Go to our website to see the very special engine that will pull the trains on those days. Obviously, these are family events. Today, to celebrate the Labor Day holiday, Paul Wearson and I, Susan Franzen, would like to play selections from one of our favorite road trips of the past. In April 2013, we visited the new James H. Andrew Railroad Museum next to the station of the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad. We spoke with the new director, Mike Wendell, as well as James H. Andrew, then 92. James died in 2014, so we were very fortunate to record his stories as he told them to us in 2013. Mike Wendell is still the director of the museum, which has a year-round schedule of events and exhibits. Let's start with a theme song for the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad before Paul Wearson introduces Mike Wendell.
Come and ride the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad. Turn back them old hands of time. See the beautiful Des Moines River Valley on the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad line.
Paul Wearson here at the James H. Andrew Railroad Museum and History Center in Boone, Iowa, near the Boone Scenic Valley Railway. And we're talking today with its director, Mike Wendell. Mike, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's a beautiful facility here. I just did a walkthrough. We're going to get more of a tour later. It's a very new facility. When was this put up?
It was opened Memorial Day weekend, and then in June we had the official opening of
last year.
Grand
opening.
Yeah. It's brand new. We've got a library here with about 900 books so far, and they're all railroad books or railroad-related books. Many books. I would say the library has grown since last May by about a third.
Really?
And this is the way this library is growing right now, I'd have to say right now it is one of the best railroad libraries in the whole Midwest, maybe the country after some years. Right, and we've had a lot of donations of books already. And then what we usually say to folks is if we have a copy already of the book, because we're always in need of funds to purchase other books, can we sell the copy that you donated and then don't have a problem with that. So then that's what we do, and then we have a book fund so that we can purchase other books too.
Now, the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway, that has a defined season, doesn't it? That the trains run?
Yeah, yeah.
What is the season?
Well, they start in May, and they run all the way to December, and that's for, during our Christmas season. And all that, it's on the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad site. Mm-hmm. It's got a whole listing. There's a whole calendar on there of events.
And so that runs in season. Mm-hmm. But your museum here is open year-round.
Yeah, we're open year-round. We're not open on Sundays during the off-season, but we are Monday through Saturday.
What are your hours here at the museum?
10 to 4.
10 to 4. Mm-hmm. So anyone can drive here to Boone, Iowa, and near the depot for the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway.
Right.
Is this facility constructed just this year?
Right.
What's your number one thing on your job here? What do you enjoy the most?
Oh, the people. Getting those life experiences of people who work for the railroads, whatever railroad it might have been in Iowa, or anywhere else for that matter in the nation. And really trying to give the younger folks an idea of what it was like, you know, to be gone for like 3 or 4 days on a run, and or working in a control tower or whatever it might be, or working as a station agent in a depot. So the real life experiences is
that really is an immediacy question, because these people are dying, and so you have that era, the golden era of railroads, where people now in their 90s and 80s and maybe 70s would have some vivid hands-on memories of that period.
Right.
And how you're reaching out to find these folks anyway you
yeah.
can.
Yeah, I mean, we love donations, but as much as important as a physical donation is those stories. And what the stories are golden. I mean, they're really important. There's no other way to give people an idea. I mean, you can do it with pictures and you can do it with objects, and that's all important too, but it's just the real-life personal stuff that means so much to me. I had a person last week who was a railroad post office worker who ran the Chicago to Council bus run. And
they were sorting mail in the cars.
In the cars. And so he'd tell me when they'd get into towards Chicago, they'd see the skyline looming up, you know, and if there was a turn, they'd be able to look out a little bit. And they knew that they were almost there. And there was a lot of pressure to get all these things sorted to where they're supposed to be, because there'd be a whole fleet of trucks waiting downtown to take the mail to other lines.
I've worked all my life on the railroad, on Chicago and Northwestern lines. For nearly 20 years, I've been an engineer, just riding those rails for life. Sometimes my wife thinks I'm crazy for loving that old railroad job of mine. Says I stay home by the phone, I just waiting to be gone, off riding those rails for life. Riding the rails, over the high bridge we go, riding the rails. Just a feeling in my soul that makes me lose control every time I hear that train whistle blow. Some of my friends, they call me a big talker. Well, Lord knows I've been known to brag sometimes. But I want you all to know, that's just the way it goes. Cause riding the rails, it is my life. Riding the rails, over the high bridge we go. Riding the rails, just a feeling in my soul that makes me lose control every time I hear that train whistle blow. I've worked all my life on the railroad, on Chicago and Northwestern lines. For nearly 20 years, I've been an engineer, riding those old rails for life. I've been riding those rails for life. Yes, I'm riding those rails for life.
After the interview in the library, Mike took us out into the huge museum space. What was your impression of this museum, Paul?
Oh, it's a nice big area. I can't believe they did it in 1 year. Total construction time. And this is a beautiful space with all kinds of hand cars and railroad relics and a cute little station house with a working telegraph and all the artifacts that go with that little
Well, it looks like a step back into the 1800s. It's a beautiful thing, and the stuff on the walls and all the flags and insignia, and it's a, if you're a railroad buff, this is the place to go. And it's so big and spacious and plenty of room for a lot of people to walk around. You're not crowded in. I love the setup.
I wanted to take a picture of the little Jefferson Station that I knew had been part of James H. Andrews' collection, and Mike was eager to show it to us.
See, I grew up in the country, and we had a party line. Our ring was one long and four short.
Is that right?
And all the women listened. Right, it was called rubbering.
Yeah.
And they, there was no private call.
That's what they always told me in a nearby town. They had a they had an operator there, and like you said, they always told me that if you didn't hear, if the volume wasn't very loud, that meant a lot of people were on there listening.
And so
remember that.
My aunt called from Minneapolis. She said, "Thelma, are you there?" She was calling my mom. "Yes." "Emma, are you there?" "Yes." And then there's a Danish couple across the road from us. She says, "Cora, are you there?" "No, this is Hans."
That's hilarious.
And so she had some news for Mom, you know, and she knew that everyone was on the line, so.
Yeah, this is a neat little building. I always said that if I died and went to train heaven, it'd be... And one of the things about the depots of Iowa is just how central all this communication stuff was in those days, you know. Yeah. You know, you'd hear about... Say Uncle Charlie passed away, but he was out east and he's coming in on the train. You know, they're going to bring his body on the train, that sort of thing, you know. Or the latest weather report. Or the station agent was always privy to anything that was happening in the town, you know. Yeah. Especially if it's outside, say, if a president is going to come through your town on the way somewhere. The station agent is the first person to hear about that. Iowa, from what I've learned since I got out here, that you could take and go in any direction in, say, 1905, for example, and take like a, you know, directional compass and go 11 miles in any direction and hit rails. You can go 13 miles in any direction and hit a depot.
So it's there's just no way that Iowa would have been what it is today without the rails. And it was more than a lot of states, because everybody was headed to Council Bluffs, you know, for the start of the Transcontinental Railroad. So, you know, you had just a lot of lines going horizontally across the state, you know, whether it be the Illinois Central or the Chicago Northwestern or Milwaukee Road or the Santa Fe, which would be in the southeast corner by Burlington Way there, Keokuk. Somewhere on the order, there was more than 1,000 depots that were built in the state.
Is that right?
Yeah, there really were. And somewhere on the order of over $1 billion in investment to build all this in those early days. And so just realizing how much money was put into the state at the beginning. You know, before the Lincoln Highway, there was literally no other way to get around the state without either interurban service, whether it be the Fort Dodge, Des Moines, and Southern, or whether it be the WCFN, then Waterloo, Cedar Falls, and Northern, east of here. Those were two very efficient ways to get yourself from one city to another. And then, of course, the major rail lines at the time.
Yeah, my mother was born in 1906. She spoke of the interurban train. You could pay a dime and get to Ames from Story City or up to Webster City.
It's really
or
efficient.
Or to Des Moines. And yeah. That really was prior to the interstate highway system, or even the 30s, when you had a lot of pavement going on.
Right.
Boy, that was the only way to get around and the only efficient way.
It really was. So you could do your grocery shopping in another town, and then you could, in fact, I read somewhere that you can be in any part of this state, in any of the smallest corners, whether it be north, south, east, or west, and still, if you were a farmer, you were still able to get your grain to market somehow, right. You know.
Yeah, it was a marvelous time, and so different from the present that this is where a museum comes in.
Right.
You have to inform people about something that's beyond their ken and their experience.
Right.
And see, I'm 70, so I go back to understanding a lot of this and remembering the tail end of the rail passenger era. But a lot of that's new to me when my mother told me those stories about the interurban. And then there are people far more removed, younger than I, who have trouble even understanding this ever existed.
Right.
And this is the role of a museum, to make sure that people have the ability to acquire knowledge about something that precedes them by decades and decades.
Right. I appreciate you defining it that way, because a lot of people don't understand that. And it's so important to... I mean, they always say if you're going to march ahead in the future, you really have to know where you've come from.
Here on KHOI today, our guest has been Mike Wendell, director of the museum here at the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway. It's the James H. Andrew Railroad Museum and History Center, newly constructed in 2012. Mike, a pleasure to meet you.
Yeah, same here.
Best of luck in the future, and that 15,000 figure will probably quadruple in no time at all.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for having me.
This is KHOI 89.1 FM, Story City and surrounding area. Today's program is a road trip with county reporters Paul Wearson and Susan Franson, and we've been visiting the James H. Andrew Railroad Museum and History Center at the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad. It's a beautiful 9,000-square-foot facility featuring a research library, theater, and displays featuring memorabilia from all eras of railroading in Iowa. Right now, we're on our way to Jefferson to visit with James H. Andrew himself.
James, thank you for welcoming us into your home.
You bet. Well, it's nice to have you here, and it's an interesting situation to recall how it all got started on the railroad business, and the fact that I had a grandfather that did a lot of traveling by rail in the early days. So in 1901, he took an immigrant car, which is a box car that you could put your horses and your cattle and hogs and chickens and even the family dog and your furniture and your farm implements and your seed and so forth, and make a trip rather than going by covered wagon. So I heard a lot of stories from him in the early days when I was a child about his experiences, and of course that got me kind of fired up on traveling and railroading. One of the amusing things was that when he would be riding on these freight trains with this immigrant car, why, the train crews were not too friendly, maybe, to helping him, because he would need water for his livestock, you see. And, of course, if they parked the train way off from where the hydrant was at, why, that was kind of an inconvenience. But he quickly found out that if he would take the excess eggs that his chickens were laying and gave them to the train crew who lived in the caboose, then they could have fresh fried eggs, and immediately they were his buddies on finding a good spot for him to take care of whatever his needs were. So that was the type of thing that that grew out of it. But that was my initial deal of being interested in railroading. And my father was a cattle feeder, and he would ship to Chicago probably 4 to 5 carloads at least a year of livestock.
They'd go by railroad.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And frequently, why, he might send 2 cars, and you were entitled to a free ticket for one person for every car that you shipped. And as a result, why, if he shipped 2 cars, why, he had means of himself getting there, but he could take me along. And of course, that was quite an experience as a young boy to get to go to Chicago and see the sights.
Now, James, date that for me. What era was that?
Well, that would be in about the area of 1938, 39.
Prior to the war.
Uh-huh.
That all was birthing of your interest in the railroads, and that led to your collections. You began to collect railroad stuff.
Yes.
So how did that begin, and when, James?
Well, I started out because I was kind of retiring from farming in about 1980, and I decided I needed a new hobby in my older years. And by golly, that was a time when the Rock Island and the Milwaukee went into bankruptcy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they had big sales as a result of closing out business.
Oh, sure.
And I kind of hit on the idea, by gosh, maybe I ought to take up collecting railroad items.
So you went to the auctions.
Yes.
What sort of things did you pick up initially?
Well, at the first sale that I went to was in September of 1980. And at that sale, I bought 2 motor cars, you know, the little putt-putt outfits.
Sure.
And that was kind of amusing because they had 35 of them for sale. And, of course, they'd been used and abused because they were going into bankruptcy, and so they didn't have money to spend. But I thought, well, if I buy 2, I can make one run out of 2 of them, probably by interchanging parts. And so I purchased 2 at $35 a piece at that time. And, of course, they had been selling higher than that, but I waited till they got down to about the 6th or 7th to come up. And by that time, when the hot purchasers were out of the way, and I could buy them for next to nothing. And so that started me off with that, and they bought a baggage cart and a few smaller things of that nature. And, of course, didn't know much about what I was doing, and so to speak. But I took off from that point and started to go on a yearly basis to the Kane County, Chicago Railroad Show, which is a big weekend affair. And they would have maybe 600 banquet tables with railroad items of every kind.
Oh, it was like a kid in a candy store.
Right.
And the stuff was everywhere.
Yeah.
And then, was that an annual event?
Well, quite often, if I could get away. It was the second weekend in June. And I think I went 14 times at least there, and then I took in a lot of other railroad shows and auctions in Kansas City and in Florida. And
so you were accumulating all this equipment. Where were you putting it?
Well, I tell you, I, of course, had the barn that you have noticed here in the back of the lot, and, of course, got a good big basement, and, of course, farm buildings because we were farming, and so I could put things at the farm and work on them there in the wintertime because we had a heated shop. And so it worked out real well that way. But eventually, why, I got enough things together that I decided that I would build a typical small rural depot. And there is, the depot now is in the museum building at Boone. They moved it over and put it in before the building was completed.
Well, now, yes, how did you marry up with the Boone and Scenic Valley Railway then? When did that occur?
Well, it was one of those situations, as I say, I went to this bankruptcy sale in 1980, and I think the Boone and Scenic Valley got started maybe about 83, something like that. So we were right at the same stage, so to speak. And through the years, why, I would go over there and ride the train occasionally and, of course, observe how they were getting along. And I could see that they were a good outfit and were expanding and were preserving a lot of railroad history. And so it became an attraction to me to see what they had gotten done. And, of course, my collecting days kind of came to an end after about 20 years. And that's when the building was under construction over there. You see the museum building. And, of course, they had to move this little depot here from here.
That was quite a project. Huh?
Yeah. Well, I had it back there under those big oak trees. I had put all that in there, which was real nice as far as the trees were concerned, but it took a real clever house mover to get it out of the trees.
Oh, it was right amongst the trees.
Oh, yeah,
to bring it
had
out
to
of
be
there.
Really zigged and zagged to get it out of there. But they successfully removed it and got it over to Boone and got it inside before the west wall went up, of course, on the big building.
It worked out beautifully.
Yes, well, I made a nice financial contribution to them towards the building. I was in a position to do that. And I've always had a great interest in history, and I thought, boy, this is a rare opportunity for Iowa, because here's this nice little scenic railroad that entertains so many people, and the museum would just tie in with it wonderfully, because when people are waiting for the train to take off, they could be browsing through the museum, you see. And
it's a great idea, and it really took off, didn't it?
Well, I was really pleased in this sense that it's a wonderful family opportunity, because particularly between grandparents and grandchildren, because you can see how they can enjoy doing something together. The kids ride the train. That's something new and different. And the grandparents have probably got some tales to tell about their travels on the railroad. So wonderful opportunity that way. And I think you can see that the activities they have over there, like this Thomas the Tank, you know, that brings in all the little youngsters.
Oh, the Thomas the Tank. Yes, that show. I see that once in a while.
Yes. Well, that just gets
that's a great thing.
Oh, they have a terrific crowd of people there for two weekends in September. And I've been over there when parking is taken up for three or four blocks around the depot.
Wow.
And as you drive around, if you observe the out-of-state license plates, you'd just be amazed at the people that have come from Illinois and Minnesota and Missouri and so forth.
That must be the most rewarding thing, to see that parking lot and see all those plates from other out-of-state. You know?
Well, it is a source of enjoyment, because I really go for things that bring the families together. And, of course, the historical importance of it is one of the things that is so meaningful, because in the long run, if you make any serious study of what made Iowa what it is today, it was the railroads. Right. Because without the railroads, how would we have ever gotten all the machinery here and the cook stoves and the lumber and the concrete and so forth to build our towns and our homes? And then, on the other hand, if we hadn't had the railroads to take the grain and the hogs and the cattle to market, how would we have gotten rid of what we were growing here? So if you take a look at, we'll say, the census of 1870 to 1880, which would be when the Transcontinental Railroad came through, why, my gosh, most of the counties probably almost gained threefold in 10 years in their population.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the people that didn't come until there was a railroad, and then they could get here so conveniently. And in my own family and in my wife's family, why, we each had illustrations of people that came out here ahead of that, saw the land, liked the looks of it, and maybe even bought some, but didn't move here
right.
until they could get here by train and their family could come quite conveniently that way.
You have been listening to recollections from James H. Andrew talking with Paul Wearson during a road trip Paul and Susan Franzen took in 2013 to the James H. Andrew Railroad Museum next to the Boone and Scenic Valley Railroad Station.
I'm heading back from Fremont on this old freight train. Across the Iowa border, rolling over these great plains. 20 years a conductor, an old locomotive riding home again. Steaming toward tomorrow, with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow. You better get on board, all aboard, for this train pulls away. Miss Kate Shelley High Bridge, we'll be crossing you real soon. Over the Des Moines River, then 3 more miles into Boone. Spend the night with my wife. Come morning, I'll be called out by noon. Steaming toward tomorrow, with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow. Better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away. Next month is my vacation, September and old puffer belly days. Gonna join that celebration with people from nearly every state. Take a ride on 1385 and feel them old-fashioned railroad ways. Steaming toward tomorrow, with dreams from yesterday. Steaming toward tomorrow, you'd better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away. I said you better get on board, haul aboard, for this train pulls away.
Thank you to Susan Franzen and Paul Wearson for that report. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Dennis Hart, your host for today. Thank you for listening. City Councilwoman Bronwyn Beattie Hansen is with us to bring you her monthly update from the Ames City Council. Thank you for joining us. Okay. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. I'm glad to be here.
When you ran for City Council a couple of years ago, you said that Ames is facing an immediate issue involving not rental properties, land use. You said that it was the biggest issue facing the city, that and the demand for more affordable housing. Well, you've been on the council now for about a year.
Yeah.
How do you feel about both of those issues? Are those still the two biggest ones that we're facing, rental problems and land use, affordable property?
I think affordable housing is probably still top on many people's minds. So, yeah, that one still stands out to me as the most critical issue that Ames is facing, yes. Yep.
And you face an immediate issue. We face an immediate one right now in that, as you know, the state of Iowa has decided that starting January 1st, Ames and other cities can no longer regulate rental properties on the basis of numbers of non-family members. How does this impact Ames now and in the future? What's the potential impact on this one?
Oh, good question. Well, I think we're seeing a lot of neighborhoods, especially in the area around campus, that are very concerned about the change in this regulation. They've seen their neighborhoods really converted to a much higher percentage of rental properties, and the density of those neighborhoods is poised to grow if we can't limit the number of adults that that can rent one unit. You know, on the other hand, though, limiting rentals based on number of individuals is sort of counterproductive in terms of the affordability of housing, actually, which is an interesting dichotomy, right? Because there are definitely situations where maybe four non-related adults would get together and rent a house so that they could all afford to live in Ames and work in Ames. And so when we regulate that, we do limit people's opportunity in that way. So it's kind of – it's interesting, two sides of the same coin there.
And both sides have valid points, very important points to be making. I was at the public forum a couple of weeks ago at the library where you had rental managers in one part of it, and then you had the property owners in a separate particular forum that night. And they both had important and serious points to be making about this one.
Mm-hmm.
So when you talk about – for example, the South Campus area neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Those property owners have seen over the years their neighborhood largely become rental properties in some areas. And there are downsides to that in
yes.
terms of noise, in terms of some law enforcement issues. So this, for them, is their livelihood. They want to stay in these neighborhoods, and now they think that that could be threatened because of the lack of regulation on rentals. What do you tell them?
Oh, I think that their concerns are certainly understandable. They have seen the percentage of homes that are rented increase drastically, and often it's parents might buy a house for their college age students, and then it gets passed on when they're done. Those concerns are real, definitely, and it does affect the value of the properties in those neighborhoods as well as just the livability, the comfort of living in those neighborhoods. So I think we do have to find a good balance, a way to protect those neighborhoods and really provide those citizens the stability that they expected when they purchased their homes, even if it was, maybe decades ago. The neighborhood they bought into has changed and is not the neighborhoods that they're turning into. So,
among the things that were discussed at that forum that could possibly be done once the rental regulations go away on January 1st, it's possible if you folks at the city council decide this, you could regulate by such things as the size of the house, student status, number of off-street parking spaces, size of a bedroom, number of bedrooms. There are ways to do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Are there any in particular that you're looking at as a council member that you would more likely be willing to support or look at than others?
Oh, good question. I would say, I'm willing to look at many of them, number of bedrooms, size of house. I think those are some fair metrics that you could apply, across the board, but I don't know yet. I'm definitely interested in looking at how we deal with the manifestations of overoccupancy, right? So you mentioned that the problem with overoccupancy is noise and overparking and
trash.
Yep, exactly. It's not just the fact that four people are living in the same house together, it's the problems they produce. And so if we could deal better with those problems or, try to prevent those, then maybe that also would be helpful, dealing with the noise and with the trash and with the, parking issues, in addition to looking at ways we can, potentially limit occupancy.
My understanding is that on September 12th, you're going to receive a report from the Inspection Division, which held the public forum at the library a couple of weeks ago, the one we're talking about. That's going to start the conversation. Where does it go from there and how quickly does it go is the question. The law ends, your existing regulations end January 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Do you foresee the council doing something between now and the end of the year to replace, at least in part, the regulations that are going away?
Good question. I would guess that we'll do some small things. I don't know about a sweeping change. I would consider a sweeping change the number of bedroom, limiting occupancy, you know, just on a number of adults or on a number of bedrooms, or limiting the number, the percentage of rental properties in a given geographical area. That would be a big, I think those would be a big step for us, and I don't know that I see that happening before the end of the year. My guess is that that we'll kind of wait and see. But there are maybe other smaller things we can do in the meantime, step up enforcement on noise, parking, garbage, you know, the symptoms, I guess.
Which is what some of the landlords said they'd like to see happen. They say there are existing ordinances that you can enforce involving noise, enforce on a better basis perhaps, but there's a cost to that too.
Yes.
Increased enforcement doesn't come free.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we did ask staff to come back to us with a cost estimate essentially of what increased enforcement would be for those things. We haven't heard that report back yet though.
So this plays right into the next issue. They are tied together is affordable housing in this community. This is a college town, obviously, and students need a place to stay. A lot of places are being built on Lincoln Way, high rises and a lot of apartments out there. And there are individual spots in Old Town here, houses that are up for rent, et cetera. In general terms, from your knowledge base, your experience, how difficult is it for Iowa State students to find housing that many of them, if not most, can afford? Is this a crisis that we have right now, or is this just a nagging issue that always is there?
You know, I would say that the big crisis for affordable housing, it doesn't strike me that that is specific to students. So I think the students have a lot of options, right? They have apartments that were designed for student living. We're starting to see a lot of incentives on apartments in the campus town area, which means probably that the market is coming back to a reasonable place in terms of what people can get out of those apartments. So students, I think, have a lot of options. They also, I mean, not that I would encourage this, but they also have student debt, which often pays for
yeah.
living, right?
Yeah.
So they have ways, I think, to make it work. Again, not that I would encourage the loans for that, but it happens. The big problem, I think, is for the working man, right? You know, it's the students, I think, have a lot of options. I think the working man or woman does not. People who have, you know, full-time jobs but are making, $15 an hour, $10 an hour, and they want to purchase a home, say, you know, maybe they don't want to rent and they want to look to buy a home. They're going to have a hard time finding as quality of a home in Ames as they could find in another community for the same dollar. That, I think, is where we see the real problem, because then we see a lot of working people commuting, you know, who can't live in Ames. That's where I see the real crunch, I guess.
What's the answer to that, aside from building more housing, and how can the council impact the answer?
Yeah, sure. Well, other than building more housing, we need to maintain what we've got. And this, I think, applies to the rental situation as well, right? So if you have a small bungalow-style house, you know, a single-family house in the campus town area, we need to keep that owner occupied in a sense. You know, we need to keep it so that a family or a working class family can still afford to buy that little bungalow, as opposed to where the market for, you know, buying it and renting out four rooms in it would cause someone to buy it to convert it. You know, I think we need to really work on protecting what we've got, our existing stock of affordable houses. So that's one bit. And then as more opportunities for student housing open up, hopefully we can find some ways to incentivize converting these rental houses back into, you know, owner-occupied or single-family style housing.
Which the neighbors would love.
Yes, exactly.
And so, we all would, yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So I think that's another key piece to, again, protecting what we've got, trying to find ways to incentivize converting back to single-family houses, and then just having a lot of options for housing. So if students are happy to live in apartment-style settings, you know, they'll clear out some of the other properties in town. So,
as if the council doesn't have enough on its plate, you are embarking on a potentially long process of updating the city's general plan. And I know this can be a snoozer for some people who don't realize the importance of this. So
yes.
in simplified terms, what does it mean? And what does it mean to update it, and why is it necessary?
Sure. Well, we are – yes, exactly. I like how you said that. It's a snoozer. It's not, though, really. This is going to be the mother of all plans is how it was described to us. Basically, so Ames currently has a land use policy plan, and that's been in place since – what would it have been? 90-something?
I believe 90? 90s.
Yeah. I should know that off the top of my head. It's probably written in my notes here. But they it's outdated. The population grew way faster than that plan thought. It needs to be updated. And so we decided this month not only to update it as a land use document, which mostly applies to zoning, you know, how you zone properties that come into the city or that that are in the city. But we decided to create a comprehensive plan, they call it, which is not just land use as it applies to zoning, but it would also address sustainability. It would address our vision for our economy, plans for workforce development. It would involve our transportation plan. It would involve or it would address civic engagement and basically it ties all the city's plans and goals into one comprehensive document. So I think it's very important that we do it right.
Why should the average person listening to us right now, and we have only above average people listening to us, that's an important thing to understand. So why should everybody listening now care about this? In other words, how does it impact their lives?
Oh, well, it'll just guide city decisions when it comes to, you know, everything in the future once this plan is established. So you know, not only zoning, so how what property looks like when it's brought into the city, you know, new property, but also the zoning of current areas in town too. And then beyond that, transportation. It'll affect how we decide to build roads or how, you know, it'll decide – it will help us guide or help guide us in our decisions for everything, right? So I guess that's why it's important.
Well, it's important if you want to be able to travel down South Duff without being caught in traffic for 35 minutes.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
I was at the council meeting where you discussed this, and part of the problem with the existing plan is that Ames grew too quickly. Nobody could foresee the increased enrollment at Iowa State mm-hmm. that was never projected. And so it's not that the plan is a bad one that's in place. It's that it's been superseded. It's just been outdated too quickly.
Yeah. Yep, that's true. The population growth has really eclipsed has grown much more than the plan predicted. So, and we've been, I think, making modifications to that plan for years now. So what it says isn't what we do anymore anyway, the current land use plan.
Okay. All right. Well, those of us who drive on Lincoln Way or Duff, we're eagerly awaiting what may happen. How quickly could this process be concluded? This is not a fast one, is it?
No, it's not. I would think years-long process.
Years.
It's going to take a lot of public input. So I think, you know, people should watch for that chance when it comes. But that will probably still be beginning of 2018 before we get rolling with public input and things like that.
You and I will be talking about this for a while then.
Yeah. Yes.
Last few minutes we have here, let's talk about SunSmart Ames. And it's a little bit confusing to me, and I've looked at this. This is an effort to bring solar mm-hmm. Into the community. In simplest terms, how does this work?
Good question. So we right now we are in the process of picking a company. There are a couple in the running to build a solar farm, we'll call it. So to take a number of acres, put solar panels up, and then people in the community can buy what they call power packs, but essentially shares in that community solar project. And so right now we are – the city is gathering interest in those shares, selling those shares in the power packs, and we hope to break ground building the solar farm, I guess is what you call it, maybe even yet this year. So,
what's the advantage to somebody buying a share? What do they get in return?
Well, it'll be twofold. I mean, some credit toward utility bill, but I think that will be minuscule, at least to start, while the price of conventional or fossil fuels is still cheap, let's say. Mm-hmm. So once, you know, at the point at which the market changes and natural gas, the price, you know, might increase beyond what it is now, at that point, then it'll probably be more financially advantageous to have solar, right? But I think also it's just the concept that we are diversifying our energy portfolio, right? So we have a lot of different sources of energy that we draw on. It makes our energy grid a little safer. So the benefit to buying a share is to support the solar energy industry too.
If people buy a share, does that mean that they get to have or will have a solar panel or two on their roofs? I mean, do they actually have something installed?
No. No, it's all at one location. Yeah, it's at one facility. And, yeah, they would just buy a share in that field.
So if this works as planned, down the road, those who buy a share in this would have some effect. It would have some effect on their bill. It would lower their monthly bill potentially.
That is my understanding, yes, that there'd be some credit given to owners of those shares. I don't know the amount. That's not been stated or decided or anything like that. But again, right now, like I said, I think the natural gas market is pretty reasonable, cheap, inexpensive. And if that ever changes, though, then we'll be really glad, I think, that we have these options. So,
last minute, you had a successful opening to your water treatment plant.
Oh, yeah.
What's the impact that plant's going to have on the community?
Well, the old plant was still working, but I think this new plant just takes us into the future. You know, it has the capacity to provide the water we'll need for a long, long time. And so I think citizens should notice no change in the quality of their water, but we just know, you know, that it allows us to provide it for years down the road.
And increased capacity with the population growth.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we need that. I mean, I think the old plant was keeping up, but right into the future, there would have been a point where it couldn't have. So yeah, we'll be able to provide water for Ames as it grows, into the next 50 years, 100 years.
And by that time, we should have a new land use plan in place.
If we're lucky.
Been a pleasure having you this morning. Thank you for coming by. City Councilwoman Bronwyn Beatty Hansen.
Thank you for having me.
You bet. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I've been your host, Dennis Hart. Earlier in the show, we heard from James H. Andrew, benefactor for the James H. Andrew Railway Museum, and Mike Wendell, director of the museum. Thank you to Susan Franson and Paul Wearson for their report. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. Also, please remember that you can hear it online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme song, as always, is Backtrackin' by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production workshop as well as a show, so if you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. Come and join the Local Talk team. Remember, you, the listener, are what makes KHOI meaningful and possible. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
KHOI is funded in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. Find job opportunities throughout Ames and Story County at workinames.com. Again, that's workinames.com.
I'm leaving town this morning, Lord. I'm never coming back. Like a lonesome eagle soaring low down these railroad tracks. Big train, let me ride with you. Take me from this place. Big train, help pull me through these dreadful lonely days. Long ago I found a love so true. We married and settled down. My poor heart died on that dark day of June when we buried her in the ground. Big train, let me ride with you. Take me from this place. Big train, help pull me through these dreadful lonely days. Find a way to ease my trouble.